Hi, everybody. Cheryl Atkison here. Welcome to another edition of the Cheryl Atkison Podcast. Today, let's talk politics, one of my least favorite subjects. I mean it when I say that politics is one of my least favorite subjects, but I watched and listened to a comedian skit recently, and it got me thinking. So I guess the best first thing for me to do right now is to play the audio of it for you. You can watch the video, by the way, by going to Twitter and looking at the account of comedian Dominic Frisbee. So that would be at Dominic Frisbee. Dominic is spelled DominicFrisby. Easier yet, you could just do a general search online for the title, We're All Far Right Now, and it will turn up. So here it is.
Polite and smart and punctual, it once was good to be. You answered for your actions, and a woman was a she. You'd stand up for your people, if needs be, even fight. But now, if you uphold such values, then you are far right. Oh, we're all far right now, we're all far right now. Peterson, Rogan, Shapiro, E-I-E-I-E-I-O. We worship Mussolini, his portrait's in the loft. Must say Twitter, hi, or Hitler, we're all far right now. Oh, you say you're in the middle, a moderate individual, a Gladstonian liberal. You once laughed at Donald Trump, you're probably a fascist too. There once was a great speaker called Martin Luther King, said character's what matters, not the colour of your skin. But conduct doesn't count now, just your identity. If you should ever question this, you're racist, obviously. Oh, we're all racist now, we're all racist now. Gallows, we must go. E-I-E-I-E-I-O. Worse than Winston Churchill, worse than Enoch Powell, Ku Klux Klan and Jimmy Fallon. We're all racist now. Oh, the countryside is racist. Dogs and cats are racist. Eating meat is racist. Black Lives Matter's even racist. Do you know what's also racist? You found out I am dyslexic. I thought I was just thick. My son, he is dyspraxic. I'd presumed he was a dick. My mother is bulimic. My mate's got OCD. My girlfriend is bipolar. That gives me anxiety. Oh, we're all mental now. We're all mental now. Off to the madhouse we must go. As a fruitcake, demented and deranged. Cuckoo, psycho, wacko, loco. We're all mental now. Oh my, what is coming next? What is coming next? What is coming next? Oh my, what is coming next? We're probably all pedos too. Dirty little pedo, hanging round the Lido, eating little speedos, far right.
It's a pretty funny video. I'd never heard of the guy, but Elon Musk retweeted this video, and I guess it kind of took off. But I guess my takeaway, sort of the main message hidden in the comedy, had to do with if everybody is accused of being something, then is anybody really that thing? And particularly when it comes to politics, we've had quite a shift in this country in the past decade or two, one that's really impacted journalism. For me, going way, way back, my family was not a political family. I don't remember my parents ever talking about politics. I don't know what political party they were registered to. I don't know who they voted for. This was not dinner table discussion in my house. And I grew up pretty agnostic to politics. I definitely didn't understand it. I wasn't interested in it. And then I went to college, ended up, of course, studying journalism at the University of Florida. But before that, before I got into journalism college, I turned 18 about three quarters of the way through my first year in college, and there were students set up on campus to register us to vote, other students who hadn't registered to vote already. And I remember walking up to the table. It was probably, in retrospect, a table of Democrats. I wouldn't have understood at the time that there might be Republicans registering and Democrats registering separately. But whoever these students were, I remember saying something like, I didn't know anything about politics, didn't know what to register as. And they told me, oh, you're a Democrat. And they registered me as a Democrat, if memory serves me correctly. And they told me who to vote for. The upcoming election would have been Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. And I didn't know anything about either one of them, but they told me, oh, you're going to vote for Jimmy Carter. I think I did. I don't remember, but I probably would have at the time because it wouldn't have made much difference to me. And it was fun to have these kids talking to me. Fast forward to I get into journalism college, and that education was not politics-centric by any means. In fact, I don't think I took a politics class. It was pretty much a good old-fashioned journalism education. We learned about how to write, how to gather facts, how to present them accurately, what legal liabilities existed as a result of our reporting decisions, and so on. Still not thinking anything about politics. I then got my first job. This would have been in 1982 at a small TV station in the West Palm Beach market, but actually in Fort Pierce, Florida. The station was a CBS affiliate called WTVX. And when I got hired there, they had just stopped making all of the reporters wear these bright orange blazers with X34 patches on the breast. But we did have a geographically inaccurate globe spinning on the set in between, this giant globe, in between the two main anchors. That was my first job, and still not a politically centric job, but politics was certainly involved in reporting in ways I didn't understand yet. That's something else I think is interesting when young journalists come on the scene. We're sort of taught to take command of a story as if we know everything or are an expert on something that we couldn't possibly be an expert on, when in fact, I think as young journalists, the best we can usually do is to go report on an event and present the facts and details as we know them, present various viewpoints and sides of a story, but not try to pretend we're an expert when we can't be. In any event, my job involved covering county commission meetings and city council meetings. And I'm sure there were a lot of politics at play in stories that I covered that I didn't understand. I do remember getting a vibe early on that we as journalists liked or were supposed to like Democrats and didn't like or were supposed to not like Republicans. Why did I pick up on that? Well, I would go interview a local political figure. I remember the name of one of them, Maggie Hirtchala, who I believe was related to the later Attorney General Janet Reno. Maggie Hirtchala was a noted environmentalist, if memory serves me correctly, in the Stuart, Florida area. And the press loved her. I came back from an interview with her and my colleagues, you know, I was pretty new. My colleagues in the newsroom, the other young people would say, isn't she terrific? And I would go, oh, yeah, she's pretty terrific, sure. And then I would go interview a Republican about something, and I don't remember a specific name in this case. But I would come back and the same colleagues would go, isn't he an asshole? And I would think, well, I didn't really notice that, but sure, yeah, I guess he is. And I started to wonder, what's the difference between a Democrat and a Republican? Because I could not have told you then, if you had asked me, what defines a Democrat and what defines a Republican? I can tell you today, but that came fairly late in my career. And my understanding of what made a Democrat a Republican when I finally did figure that out is really not the case anymore today. But I understood it once I looked into it to mean Democrats tended to be more socially liberal and accepting of things that other people might consider sort of fringe or on the edge socially. Maybe they were okay with drugs and illegal drugs and behavior that would not be considered the centrist of society. And they spend a lot of money. You know, they believe that the government or taxpayer money should fund a lot of stuff, whereas, this is what I thought at the time, Republicans were quite different. They were more likely to frown on the behaviors and policies that the Democrats embraced, more likely to think people shouldn't be doing all of those things, and they were, at least I thought at the time, fiscally conservative, less likely to believe that our tax dollars should fund everything. So that was the basic breakdown I came to understand. But in the beginning, I didn't think any of that. I just knew there were Democrats and Republicans. And when I asked my colleagues to tell me what was the difference at that first job I had in 1982, they really couldn't and didn't define it well for me. So it was a long time before I came to have my own understanding. But one thing I knew pretty early, I was not interested in politics, why people were Democrats or Republicans, or in covering political angles to stories. And I know a lot of reporters love that. They want to be political reporters. They live for that. And I just wasn't interested. So throughout my career at local news, WTVX, X34 in Vero Beach, and then in Columbus, Ohio, WBNS, the CBS station there, and then at WTVT, the CBS station in Tampa, I continued to cover stories in a way that very rarely, if ever, veered into a political story. Then I went to CNN for 3 years and anchored and reported there. And then I joined CBS, where I was for more than 20 years, reporting initially headquartered in New York and then in the Washington, D.C. bureau, where I became an investigative correspondent and was able to avoid reporting much on politics, which I loved. And maybe that's one reason that a lot of my reporting got so much attention, particularly my investigative reporting. I tried to make it more often than not, although sometimes it was unavoidable, but more often than not, I tried to make it where even if I was reporting on a controversy that perhaps could fall under a political heading, I didn't mention a top political figure or try to tie blame directly to that person or party. That was left up to viewers to do if they wished to do it. I saw both parties, as I covered national news stories and scandals, as equally problematic. For example, when I covered the Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP, which became the bank bailout, when I covered that story, I didn't mention that this was President Bush's fault or somebody's fault in particular. I just stuck to the facts that this was a program that was billed as one thing. It was supposed to be a consumer plan to help consumers. But when the bank lobbyists got involved, it became what I called a bait and switch, a bailout for the big banks. But I did not harp on or blame or talk about President Bush throughout the whole thing. When there was the BP oil spill, which was under President Obama, I certainly didn't see the spill as President Obama's fault, although today, if something like that were covered, it would almost surely be blamed by one side or the other on whoever was in charge, depending on the political expediency. But I just covered the fact that this oil was spilling into the ocean and our own federal agencies were misleading us on how much was spilling out. In fact, apparently I was the first and only reporter when CBS assigned me to dip into it about 3 weeks after the disaster, the first and only reporter to ask for the video because I knew intuitively there would be undersea cameras and that they would have recordings of the oil. And I worked with two members of Congress to get the videos because the federal agencies were withholding them improperly. And the Democrats at the time, being environmentalist-minded, wanted the videos. And when I aired the live feed on the CBS Evening News for the first time, I think that was a game changer. We were able to have analysts look at the video and prove that what the government had said and what BP had said was leaking out was far less than what was really leaking out. This was a huge story. The tone of the story changed because at first everybody was all over it. And then people started to think, boy, this reflects poorly on President Obama. Now, I hadn't reported that, but it started to feel that the Obama administration did not like the reporting on this. And those Democrat members of Congress who had been working with me to get the video kind of clammed up and I think were told to stand down a little bit on the story and the criticism. So politics would come into play with these stories, but I tried not to emphasize them. Then there was a time when I was assigned to do earmarks to cover these wasteful spending of tax dollars on pet projects by members of Congress. And there were so many ridiculous earmarks made by members of each party. It was super easy to try to divide them up and say, you know, 1 week I will pick a Republican earmark and another week I will pick a Democrat earmark because There were so many and both parties were guilty. I didn't want it to look like I was only picking one side or the other. So in that case, I was taking into consideration politics because these members of Congress were directly requesting the earmarks. But again, like I said, I was usually able to avoid a strictly political job. And then over the years at CBS, when there would come an election year, they would sometimes try to assign me a candidate. And I managed to wiggle out of that so that I didn't have to cover candidates. I remember when Sarah Palin became the vice presidential choice for Republican John McCain, there was someone's bright idea at CBS that I should follow Sarah Palin around and cover her for CBS. And I knew, this is one of the reasons I avoid covering politics, or I did, I knew that was a no-win situation. I knew that the inside producers at CBS who were involved in politics did not like Sarah Palin. Hate might not be too strong a word for that. And I knew that if I were assigned to cover her, I would be expected to dig up negative stuff every day, regardless of what the truth was. And I don't think that would be fair. Or if I ever reported anything positive or not negative about her, I would be criticized internally and be facing accusations that I wasn't doing a fair job. Again, I feel like it's sort of a no-win situation. But what does all of this have to do with that video, the audio that I played for you a few minutes ago? And I was thinking how through most of my career, if people called me anything or guessed that I was anything politically, they guessed or called me left-wing or a liberal. When I married a local sheriff's department official back in 1984, I remember some of his friends at the sheriff's office calling me the liberal media. I'd never heard that phrase before. Didn't quite know what it meant. I knew it was considered an insult, but they would tease me and call me the liberal media. But I didn't really care much one way or the other. And I got called that pretty consistently off and on if somebody called me anything. And you know, maybe in retrospect, that was more accurate than not. Once I started to understand as an older journalist how politics comes into play in reporting and issues and policies, I really worked hard to examine what I had done in the past and reported and how I was reporting currently and what biases I might have slipped into my reporting inadvertently or unintentionally. And I tried to make it my goal where you shouldn't be able to guess what I am by my investigative reporting on a topic, or maybe if you do guess, you might be guessing the wrong thing because the reporting is simply going where the reporting takes you. And that approach worked for a very long time. I would say that most of the places I worked and most of the bosses I had, to the extent I know what they were liberal or left-leaning, but fair. I'll go back to CNN where Ted Turner, ultra-liberal environmentalist, owned CNN and, to my knowledge, didn't interfere at all, certainly didn't interfere with my work and what I wrote and what I did. I thought CNN was a great organization. When I was there from 1990 to 1993, I didn't know the politics of the anchor I sat next to for 3 years, Lou Waters. He didn't know mine. We didn't talk about it. It just didn't come up. It was a different type of newsroom back then than it is today. Then when I worked at CBS, I understood that the corporate bosses were liberal donors and liberal billionaires. I worked for PBS, which I understood to be a liberal or left-leaning organization. I anchored a health news magazine under the Washington Post moniker called Health Week. That's while I was working at CBS as well. And one of my best executive producers, and I had a lot of good ones at CBS before things really went off the rails toward the end of my time there. One of my best executive producers was Rick Kaplan, who I think would openly admit he's a liberal guy and socializes in those circles and yet was very fair. This was as a journalist should be. This was a guy who, for him, a great story was a great story no matter where it went. One anecdote about that, when I came back from a trip out of the country and heard that Hillary Clinton had falsely claimed we had been shot at by snipers some 12 years earlier on our trip to Bosnia. I had traveled along on that trip to cover it for CBS News when she was first lady. We weren't shot at on the trip. And when she was claiming as she was running for president that she had been shot at, I dug out the video to show that when we landed on the tarmac, she said we she and Chelsea ran for cover and ducked and ran. And I was able to show with the video that I had saved, which is kind of unusual because I don't normally save video. But I was able to show that there was calm on the runway, that she greeted a little girl with flowers, took photographs with the troops, the U.S. troops who were there. There was no emergency or shooting. And I remember when I told Rick Kaplan that I had sort of the goods on a big story, but that I knew he was friends with the Clintons, at least that's what I'd heard. Well, he scheduled a story to lead the evening news that night, and I said something on the phone with him like, sorry, I know you're friends with the Clintons. And he said something like, I'm not that close. It's a great story. And I think that was the attitude of most of the people I dealt with for most of my time as a journalist. Yes, some of the people making decisions might have political overtones, but for the most part, they were fair-minded people and understood that we were serving an audience and that they weren't letting their own hopes and desires and political beliefs get in the way. Obviously, all that's changed now. I'm just telling you how my perception is of how it used to be. So what does all of this have to do with the audio that I played for you a few minutes ago? Well, things have really changed. I don't need to tell you that. But newsrooms have become so politicized and in most cases toward the left and so biased and so politically charged based on the people who they've hired and brought into the newsrooms, based on those who are influencing what's reported, that if you don't report the left-wing narratives on certain topics, you are automatically called or considered right-wing, as ridiculous as that may be. And this is no accident. I began tracking this phenomenon and this strategy probably 2 decades ago. I've written a little bit about it in my books, Stonewalled, The Smear, and Slanted. There are special interests that work behind the scenes to try to controversialize stories by labeling the people who did them, the journalists who reported them, as partisans. Because if that could be successfully done, and there's a story that reflects negatively, or they think it does, on their political candidate of choice, if they can make you, the reporter, appear as though you're politically biased, half of the people will disregard what you've reported, no matter how truthful, fair, and accurate it may be. Really a brilliant and effective strategy. And in those instances, it doesn't really matter what the truth is. You can point to or prove your story being factually accurate and fair. But as soon as someone has turned it into political red meat, there's no point because a lot of people have turned off. They're just not going to listen. You're a partisan. This strategy has been so effective and pervasive, and so many of America's newsrooms have become so far left that that's the new central starting point as far as they're concerned. Everything should be reported from this left viewpoint. And I will throw in there from the pharmaceutical government industrial complex viewpoint, which seems to intersect with these left interests for some reason. So if you are not on the same page, if you are what they would consider slightly right of that, which may be in the middle, you will be falsely labeled and smeared as far right. And the left-leaning interests, in many instances, journalism groups, or they used to be journalism groups themselves, who are doing the criticizing of other reporting and journalists, apparently have no self-awareness that they are belying their own biases by basically making their launching point, their starting point of fairness, be far left, and by complaining that anybody who is not on that narrative is by definition, therefore, far right. One more real-life story along those lines. When I broke the Fast and Furious story at CBS, well, by way of background, let me just summarize that some whistleblowers at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, a federal agency, blew the whistle on the fact that the government, the federal government, had been running operations, one of them called Fast and Furious, putting weapons, assault rifles and other weapons, into the hands of Mexican drug cartels, believe it or not. Sounded so far-fetched. But when I reported this story, I didn't see it as a Democrat and Republican story. It was under the Obama administration, although shades of this type of strategy had begun under the Bush administration. Clearly, the Obama administration had stepped it up because there were a lot of these operations going on simultaneously. But in the beginning, I didn't seek to politicize it and didn't see this as, for example, President Obama's fault, although, of course, he was asked to account for and answer for it, as was his attorney general, Eric Holder. The Department of Justice was the umbrella organization for these secret programs that were at first falsely denied by the agencies and officials. But the night I put whistleblower John Dodson, a current sitting federal agent, on the air on the CBS Evening News exposing this operation that the government had denied, it was a huge story. And nobody was quite sure, nobody in Washington, D.C., who this story made look bad. Was it Democrats or Republicans? And something I came to learn is every story will be politicized in that way. Every big scandal or investigation has to be portrayed as either something the Democrats did wrong, and the people behind the scenes pulling strings on all of this, they're the ones who make that determination and start spinning all of us. But at the very beginning of Fast and Furious, nobody was sure which way that was going to fall. And I began getting calls from members of Congress and staffers, both on the Senate side in Capitol Hill and the House side. They knew this was a huge story, and each side was looking for ways to perhaps capitalize on it or investigate it. And one of the most aggressive in the beginning was a prominent Democrat senator who wanted more information and to know what steps Congress could take to further this investigation. As a reporter, obviously, I have no subpoena power. So if a congressional committee in the House or the Senate, I don't care whether they're led by Democrats or Republicans, but if they take interest in a story and can get additional information, I'm all for it. So I was speaking to a staffer of this important member of the Senate, and I was also fielding calls from some Republicans along the same lines. And one day, the calls from the Democrats seemed to halt. The follow-up stopped, and I didn't know why that was the case. And I called that Senate staffer that I had been dealing with, and he told me that they weren't sure what they were going to do about the Fast and Furious story after all. And I said, well, why? What changed? And he said something like, we can't figure out how this plays with the gun control crowd. Now, again, this was not a story that to me had implications directly with the gun control crowd, whoever that may be. But obviously, that's a really big and powerful movement. And he talked a little bit more about how this could be something that is good for gun control. This could be something that is ultimately bad for gun control as the story develops. And I remember saying to him, aren't some stories just by themselves important enough not to worry about where they're going to go like that? And I remember him saying, this is probably close to verbatim, you'd like to think so, wouldn't you? And that was the last time I ever heard from him. The Republicans, on the other hand, at least one of them, Daryl Issa in the House, maintained their interest, the initial interest they had expressed, and they became the ones digging up a lot of information, and it did become a political story despite my best efforts and hopes that it wouldn't be, simply because it had Eric Holder's fingerprints all over it after the denials that they knew anything about it. There were documents that showed he'd been well briefed on it weekly or every couple of weeks for quite some time. And then after denials that the White House knew anything about it, there were documents showing that White House officials had indeed communicated about all of this. And then ultimately, President Obama stepped in and declared executive privilege to withhold a bunch of documents about this case. I think for the one and only time of his presidency, obviously this becomes more of a political story. But what I'm trying to say is, behind the scenes, as we cover our stories fully and fairly, and try to make it where it doesn't point unfairly in a political direction, there are many powerful forces trying to controversialize the story or exploit the story, but in any event, define it in political terms. And it's to the point where, regardless of what you cover, in some respects, it's almost a no-win situation because half the people, depending on where someone decides the story points, half the people are going to say that you are a partisan for reporting it. The other half might embrace it, but it seems like the days are pretty much gone where an investigative reporter like me can just do a great story and have it received with an open and fair mind by most people because they are subject to these strategies and spins that are put out there by the people pulling strings behind the scenes. I hope this gives you a little bit of interesting insight into what happens from a journalist's point of view and how things have changed over the years. Something to keep in mind as you consume your diet of news. Stick with me after a short break. I will tell you why I don't think political pundits and former party officials should be hired in America's newsrooms, whether they're Democrats or Republicans.
We're all far right now. We're all far right now. Peterson, Rogan, Shapiro, E-I-E-I-E-I-O. We worship Mussolini. His portrait's in the loft. Must say Twitter, hi or Hitler. We're all far right now.
Today, our information landscape is marred by propaganda and corruption, much of it influenced by the pharmaceutical, government, media complex. And there's evidence it's impacting our health in a major way. Since you're listening to this podcast, I know you're an independent thinker, and you're going to love hearing what I've learned about how it works, who's behind it, and what you can do. In my new book, Follow the Science, How Big Pharma Misleads, Obscures, and Prevails. You can order from the bookstore of your choice or at HarperCollins or Amazon. Look for Follow the Science by Cheryl Akison.
Introducing Whipped Seafoam Body Butter by Sirenae Cosmetics.
Hi, I'm Star, owner of the Lemonade Mermaid.
Enriched with the nourishing powers of cocoa butter, mango butter, and shea butter, our body butter whisks you away to a world of deep hydration. Experience the essence of the sea with every application as this whipped delight leaves your skin refreshed, replenished, and ready to conquer the day. Visit thelemonademermaid.com and make your skin sing with the magic of the sea.
So if you missed the controversy, NBC had hired the controversial former Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel to appear on NBC. I don't know what the terms of her hiring were. I will say that in general, consultants can get hired to be exclusively available to a network for commentary and appearances. Those are typically six-figure salaries, even though they may not work every day or very much at all, but they're available. If they're going to actually do a TV program, a regular program, it can be much more than obviously just a basic consulting fee. But in any event, some of the talent at NBC and MSNBC kind of went ballistic that the network would be hiring this Republican official. And NBC, after that criticism from on the inside, reversed this decision and reportedly decided to rescind their offer to Ronna McDaniel. And a lot of people are debating the fine points of all of this. But my position is political pundits and former party officials and people like that, they don't belong in newsrooms at all. In my view, this is all part of inappropriate transaction journalism. By that, I mean people are being hired and paid for other reasons than they're providing some kind of original, insightful commentary. That's why you may see a political commentator be so wrong over and over about important things, and yet the same news network still relies on that person. That explains why you see Donna Brazile, who was with the Democratic National Committee and allegedly made sure to favor Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders, going so far as to, as reports said, leak questions in advance of a town hall, a CNN town hall where she was consulting for, leak advance questions or a question to Hillary Clinton so that she would have a good answer, where the same favor was not done to Bernie Sanders. And yet, even after all this controversy, she continues to be consulted for opinions and expertise as if she can provide something remarkable that you can't get anywhere else. Karl Rove continues to be consulted, and I've got nothing against Mr. Rove. He seems like a very nice person, but he's been really wrong about a lot of important things. He insisted Donald Trump didn't have a prayer, and you might wonder why, when some of these predictions are so wrong, again, that the news networks keep turning to the same people over and over again. If they were serving an audience, these news organizations, and getting the best, most accurate and insightful commentary, that would be one thing, but that's not what they're doing. I'll go so far as to say that these commentators or party officials, they should be paying for the favor of being allowed to spin viewers on a news network, not the other way around. It's quite an amazing feat of propaganda that news organizations have somehow become convinced or pretended to become convinced that hiring and paying these political people big salaries somehow benefits viewers. All they're doing, these news organizations, is allowing themselves to become tools of political propagandists, giving them terrific outlets so that they can reach millions of people with their political spin. And at the same time, they're getting paid for it. How wild is that? All you're really getting from them is whatever spin they or the party wants out there, and you're giving them as a news organization this vehicle to put the information out and spread their propaganda, and then paying them for the favor. I think much the same about these intelligence agency folks who then go on to commentate. Listen, there's an old saying that once you work for the CIA or whoever it is, you're always working for the CIA. But regardless of what the precise facts are about that, we know that these intelligence officers are hugely politically influential and many times conflicted. And it reminds me of when I worked at CBS News, we hired Mike Morrell, the former deputy director of the CIA and acting director of the CIA, to do political commentary while he was working for a PR firm that was started by Hillary Clinton loyalists while she was running for president. And we didn't disclose that to our viewers. So we were putting Michael Morrell on television on CBS, remarking about various issues in ways that made one side or the other look better or worse, without telling the public that he basically was a Hillary Clinton supporter. And I went to the ethics officials at CBS News because I think this violates basic tenets of journalism ethics. And I said that, look, if we're going to invite someone like that into our newsroom, that's your decision. But we have an obligation to disclose to viewers what his financial ties are so that they can weight his opinions and his judgments. And at the time, he was being paid by this PR firm on behalf of Hillary Clinton. And the people at CBS disagreed. They didn't think that we needed to routinely disclose Michael Morrell's conflict of interest to our viewers. I think more often than not, when these types of people are invited into our newsrooms, there's something else in play other than us trying to get honest, insightful commentary. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and that if you did, you'll leave us a great review, subscribe, and share it with your friends. Check out my other podcast, Full Measure After Hours. And now you can support independent journalism causes by visiting CherylAckison.com and clicking on the store tab. There are some thought-provoking and fun products designed exclusively for independent and free thinkers like you, such as products with the slogan, I need to find some new conspiracy theories. All my old ones came true. Proceeds benefit independent reporting causes. Do your own research, make up your own mind, think for yourself.